time to bed.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principle. Your host, Peter Shank, who is not here. I'm here instead. I'm Scott Horton. I do the weekend interview show Saturdays from 3 to 5. You could check out the archives at weekendinterviewshow.com. And I'm filling in for Peter because he's off on assignment and we'll be back tomorrow night. Now, to bring on our guest, Bill Lind. He's the director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation, is a former congressional aide, and is the author of many books and articles on war and military strategy. His Marine Corps manual for fourth-generation warfare was found in caves in Afghanistan. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Lind, you say that America is facing in Iraq. What America is facing in Iraq right now is fourth-generation warfare. What were the first three generations, and what marked the change to the fourth?
The period we're talking about here, the period of modern war, really begins in the year 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War. What that peace treaty did is it gave states, first in Europe and then gradually, as time went on throughout the rest of the world, a monopoly on war. Now, when we think of war today, we think of it naturally as something between states, state armies and navies fighting other armies and navies like themselves. But through most of history, that wasn't true. Through most of history, many different entities waged war. Families, tribes, clans, religions, ethnic groups, ideologies, business enterprises, all kinds of groups waged war. And they used many different tools, not just armies and navies. They used assassination. They used immigration. Rome wasn't brought down by hostile armies. It was brought down by vast immigration of barbarians.
Okay, so
what's happening now as we move into the fourth generation is the state is losing that monopoly. Briefly, the other two generations, second generation war is what comes out of World War I on the Allied side, which is essentially war as the United States Armed Forces still practice it, firepower attrition warfare. War is simply reduced to a matter of putting firepower on targets. Third generation is maneuver warfare, which is developed by the German Army in World War I, and we think of it as it manifested itself in the Blitzkrieg in World War II. It's war where the primary weapon is time and speed more than it is firepower.
And then, so the first generation then was like the British used to fight lined up in the field. And...
Right. It's linear warfare. It is both at sea and on land. The object is to put your forces in a line and bring them up against the enemy's line and bang away until one runs away or gives up. The importance of the first generation for us today is that the battlefield of order, which lasted for about two centuries, created the military culture of order. And the things we associate today as defining the difference between military and civilian all recognize and reinforce that culture of order, things like uniform and saluting and careful gradation of ranks and all of those sorts of things. The problem is that the battlefield of order began to break down about the middle of the 19th century, about the time of our Civil War. And ever since then, the military culture has been increasingly contradictory to the increasingly disorderly environment in which it has to operate. Part of the reason state armed forces have so much trouble with the kind of non-state opponents they now find themselves fighting all over the world.
Sort of like what's happened in the news recently where our Marines went into Samarra and all the insurgents basically just evaporated.
Sure. And that's, of course, they're taking that right out of Chairman Mao's book that says when the enemy attacks, we retreat. His little manual on guerrilla warfare. The basic problem is that second-generation armed forces like ours can't come to grips with fourth-generation opponents because second-generation war, which is, again, is developed primarily by the French Army in World War I, is all about putting firepower on targets. But fourth-generation opponents aren't targetable. They don't wear uniforms. They don't have distinctive military equipment like tanks and artillery pieces and fighter planes. You can't tell a fourth-generation fighter from his next-door neighbor who's simply a shopkeeper.
Right. So when the president, like he did during the debate last week, when he says that, well, we've killed three-quarters of al-Qaeda's leadership, does that not really count for anything?
No, it really doesn't. Because al-Qaeda, like fourth-generation organizations generally, is not a top-down organization. It doesn't work by somebody at the top giving orders like a general to the colonels and then the colonels to the lieutenant colonels and so forth. It's a very loose network. And so this is not a snake that you can kill by cutting its head off. It's a completely different kind of thing. If we capture or kill bin Laden tomorrow, it will make very little difference.
It might even make them more powerful by giving him martyr status, right?
Well, precisely. I mean, we're fighting. Let me give you a good example. A friend of mine who teaches at the Naval Academy in Norway, where I lectured in May on this, said some of the Norwegian Special Forces guys said to him, well, we're really the people for fourth generation war. And his reply was, really? You believe in something so deeply you're raising your daughters to be suicide bombers for it? There was a long silence. Fourth generation war, the change is not simply how people fight. The change is in who fights and what they fight for.
So these they're not obeying their commanding officer. They're doing what they want to do.
There is no such thing. And that has its weak sides as well as its strong sides. But this isn't again, these are non-state militaries. They don't look like state militaries with their uniforms and their rank structures and all of the rest of that sort of thing. Who fights can be every male who's old enough but not too old to carry a weapon, as was true in times before the Peace of Westphalia through most of the world. And what they fight for is no longer simply Clausewitz's politics by other means. In many cases, they're fighting just to fight. If you look like at a place like Iraq, an enormous number of the population, enormous percentage of the population, I think it's somewhere around 40% in Iraq, is 16 years old or younger, and they have nothing to do. What do young men who have nothing to do want to do?
Fight.
Right, exactly. As my friend Martin Van Creffeld, whose book The Transformation of War is probably the best book on all of this, he's on the faculty at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, puts it, war exists because men like to fight and women like fighters.
So when the American military goes in using third-generation tactics...
Second.
Second?
Second, we have not made it into the third generation. The effort that I've been involved in for 30 years now has essentially been trying to move the American military from the second generation to the third. The Marine Corps has made the most progress of any of the services, but it has by no means made the jump yet. If you go to the Marine schools at Quantico, what's being taught is still second-generation warfare. I mean, it's literally still out of the French textbooks of World War One.
Well, was the original invasion seems to count as kind of a blitzkrieg thing with the shock and awe and the troops driving right by the enemy in order to just race straight to Baghdad and that kind of thing, no?
That was. That was, particularly in the case of the Marines who did a lot of that. The shock and awe stuff was utter nonsense. But
so now it's gone back to second generation as we're occupying the place.
Exactly. The problem was that, from our standpoint, the Iraqi strategy outmaneuvered our blitzkrieg because the soldiers just took their weapons and went home and waited to fight another day.
That's what George Bush calls the catastrophic success.
Yes. And the effect of that, particularly when we made the incredibly idiotic move of disbanding the Iraqi military instead of calling it back to work for us and keep order, and some of it would have done that, the effect of it was to enormously increase the speed with which the other side could organize a guerrilla war. So the problem with Blitzkrieg is the enemy can sidestep it, and in this case he did. Now, however, don't think that because we could do that against Iraq in a particular situation that is generally how the American military operates. We could do it against Iraq because the Iraqi military essentially didn't fight. So we could follow our plans. The real test of whether a military has moved to the third generation is whether it can respond quickly and imaginatively when its plan goes wrong, when the enemy does things it doesn't expect. And as we're seeing in Iraq, the answer with the American military is no.
Right. Well, there's been much hay made about military transformation. Isn't that why they turned all the policy over to Paul Wolfowitz? Because Donald Rumsfeld was focusing on remaking the military to be lighter, stronger, faster, and all that.
The problem is this is in the... In the 1989 article that I co-authored in the Marine Corps Gazette that first laid out fourth-generation warfare, we said there are two ways war may go in the future. The one is the fourth generation. The other is what's become known as the revolution in military affairs, which is what Rumsfeld and transformation represent. That direction says future war will remain between states and it will be dominated by high technology. Well, it's pretty clear at this point that isn't the way war is going.
And they're sort of imagining it will be, when they say war between states, they mean war between the United States and the tiny little rogue states.
Well, there's quite a camp in Washington that's looking forward to a war with China, which would, of course, be strategic idiocy. But what they're looking for, it's often called a peer competitor. In other words, it's another country like us that has a very, very expensive, very high-tech military that fights within these very careful rules where militaries only fight militaries, fighter planes, tanks fight tanks, etc. But that if we fight China, I guarantee you that isn't the way the Chinese are going to fight. And the way war is going in any case is not within the state framework. All over the world, states are being confronted by non-state opponents, and almost everywhere the state is losing.
Well, you know, I really have a hard time rooting for the state.
Well,
depends which state, I guess.
You have to understand why the state arose. And you have to look back in history to do that. Again, I here reference another book of Martin Van Creveld's, which is The Rise and Decline of the State. If we go back about 1,000 years, we find ourselves in the Middle Ages. Now, contrary to what most people now think, the Middle Ages are a very high civilization. If you ever see the cathedral at Chartres or the Saint-Chapelle in Paris, you'll quickly realize that. What brought the Middle Ages down was the plague. And after the Middle Ages disintegrate, what you get is a time of just enormous disorder. Best book on that is probably Barbara Tuchman's A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century.
Okay, we'll have to hold that and get back to the 14th century right after this break. The guest is Bill Lind. He writes for Lou Rockwell and antiwar.com. You should look up and read his stuff. It's incredible stuff. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton, the host of the Weekend Interview Show, filling in. He'll be back tomorrow night, so stay tuned for that. And the guest is Bill Lind. He writes a syndicated column that you can read at antiwar.com or lourockwell.com. He's the director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation, a former congressional aide, and is the author of many, many books and articles on war and military strategy. Now, sir, when we went to the break, you were talking about the calamitous 14th century.
I was talking about the period between the fall of the medieval order and the rise of the state.
Right.
It was a nasty time to be alive. It was, as Hobbes said, life was nasty, brutish, and short. You were constantly at the mercy, you, your wife, your family, your property, of bands of armed men who called themselves soldiers but were controlled by no state. And when they weren't hired by someone to fight a war, they simply took whatever they needed. They had the weapons. They had the skills. And the state arose to bring order. It didn't promise liberty. It didn't promise prosperity. It didn't promise happiness. It simply promised order, and that it brought. If you look at woodcuts of Germany after the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, the trees are full of corpses. They're the corpses of men who were soldiers that were not in state armies. The state armies went out, rounded them all up, and hanged them. And thereby, the state brought order. And life without something to provide order is pretty unpleasant. Now, the way the world is going, it may not be the state that does that in the future. One of the most dramatic statements about a very non-Marxist withering away of the state has been the explosion in the business of private security. That is a dramatic statement that the state is failing everywhere.
Well, and that's surely a preferable withering away. Surely is preferable to a dictatorship of the proletariat if it's two different paths to a stateless world that you're looking for.
Well, certainly. But again, I have to say that people who think life would be great if there were no state need to answer the question, okay, then what provides order? Because life where, again, your life, your family, your property, everything is constantly at the mercy of anyone who comes along who's stronger than you are and wants to take it, is not very pleasant.
Right. Well, I think I'll let you and Hans Hoppe argue the finer points of private property anarchy. And we'll stick to fourth generation warfare here for a second. Does this era that we're moving into now, does this have to be a clash of civilizations, the West versus Islam and all this, the way it's seeming to come together now?
Well, we have to understand that Islam and Christendom have been at war ever since Islam first came riding out of the Arabian desert around the year 700. And that's part of the nature of Islam. Islam mandates jihad. And jihad means that Islamics must fight, and they don't mean that metaphorically, until everyone in the world submits to Islam. That's what the word Islam means. It doesn't mean peace, as we're sometimes told now. It means submission. The question question is, first of all, is Islam going to be on the strategic defensive or the strategic offensive? After the failure of the Second Turkish Siege of Vienna in 1683, Islam went on the strategic defensive for about 300 years. It's now again resuming the strategic offensive, and it's expanding outward in every direction. The other question is, are we going to adopt a strategy that enables Islam to overcome its many internal divisions and focus outward, or is our strategy going to try to turn its own energies back on itself, to fold it back on itself? The problem is the offensive strategy that both Bush and Kerry represent minimizes Islam's internal divisions and allows them to focus on us. And that's probably not a very good idea.
Well, don't they have advisors as smart as you to explain how, other ways that they might go about fighting Islam without, or fighting the terrorism without consolidating the enemy over there?
The intellectual level of the debate in Washington is about as low as you can imagine. The kind of people who get in important positions in our government are not people who think seriously about these kinds of subjects. They are people who are very good at kissing politicians' backsides. They are courtiers. Their expertise is in the intricate politics of court, and Washington is at this point very much an imperial court. And in Washington court politics, the outside world and outside reality really doesn't matter very much. What matters is the politics of court. So the kind of discussion that we're having here, you would think this kind of discussion goes on in Washington all the time. It does not. Because Washington thinks almost not at all, and I include Congress here, in how to govern the country. What Washington thinks about is how to benefit itself.
Well, and I guess if they consolidate their enemies in the Middle East against them, then they're actually doing better for themselves, right? Because now they have a more dangerous enemy even to fight against now.
There is a fair amount of truth to that. What succeeds in Washington is what brings more power, more money, more empire. And, of course, war does that very, very well. What really began our transformation from a republic into an empire was our entry into World War I. The progressives, of whom, of course, Woodrow Wilson was one, wanted to see an enormous expansion in federal government power. And the way to do that was to get into war. So Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And within 1 month of his inauguration to his second term, we were in that war. And the government expanded enormously.
Yeah, they outlawed dissent at your own dinner table, right?
Beg your pardon?
They outlawed dissenting at your own dinner table, right?
It certainly became dangerous.
Okay, can you stay on for a little bit longer? We can take this break and come back with a couple more questions?
Yes.
Okay, good deal. We'll be right back, everybody, with Bill Lynn. Definitely check out his archives at antiwar.com and look up the Free Congress Foundation. Look them up on the internet. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton, the host of the Weekend Interview Show, Saturday afternoons from 3 to 5, weekendinterviewshow.com, and I'm filling in for Peter tonight. And my guest is Bill Lind, and he's a military history expert and writes a syndicated column you could read at antiwar.com or lewrockwell.com. And now, sir, we could sit here and bash Woodrow Wilson for the rest of the show, although I'm not sure you'd get a word in edgewise if that's the path we keep going down.
He is definitely the worst president we ever had, which makes it a little
up until now,
beg your pardon?
Up until now.
Well, I was going to say, which makes it interesting when we see in a supposed conservative, Mr. Bush, Wilsonianism. There's no other word for it.
Well, actually, they added a prefix on it now. Max Boot at the Council on Foreign Relations said, this is hard Wilsonianism. We're Wilsonians, but we really mean it, and we'll kill you.
Unfortunately, Wilson meant it the same way, and that's why we got into World War One. But it's bizarre, to say the least, to find someone who was Wilsonian calling himself a conservative and having people believe it. And unfortunately, what it attests to is how little Americans now know about history.
Well, indeed, it's true. In fact, I was this has come up on this show or on my show a few times now. There was something that Bin Laden wrote not too long ago where he talked about getting revenge for the disgrace of 80 years ago, which I assume was referring to us helping Great Britain take over the entire Middle East at the end of World War One, right?
Well, he was referring specifically to the fall of the Ottoman Caliphate. In Islamic history, in Islamic political theory, the only legitimate authority is the caliph. And when the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman monarchy, finally fell in 1923, that was the last caliph. The state is not legitimate in Islamic political theory. There's only the Ummah, the community of all believers, and the caliph. So from Bin Laden's perspective, the fact that there is no caliph is catastrophic, and he blames the U.S. and Britain for that. Actually, only indirectly is that the case. What brought down the Ottoman monarchy was the rebellion in Turkey led by the man we now call Atatürk, Kemal Pasha.
Well, and they were surely weakened by their participation in World War One.
Oh, yes, enormously.
Right. Now, the question is, if the state, i.e. the West in this case, if we cannot fight fourth-generation warfare in their land, as we're attempting to do now in Iraq and Afghanistan, how do we fight this war?
Well,
just ideas, right?
Let me give two answers to that.
Okay.
The first and larger answer is, at this point, nobody knows. Fourth-generation war is too new. We're all the blind man and the elephant trying to walk around it and see this aspect of it and that aspect of it and figure out what it is. I've got a small seminar that meets at my house, made up mostly of Marine officers, some Army as well, that's trying to write literally an unofficial field manual on this. It will be a long time before we have learned much about this. Other countries, the British particularly, we have a Royal Marine officer in the seminar, have rather more experience at it than we do. The other answer is, again, coming back to my point, that we need the strategic defensive rather than the strategic offensive. I've got a major piece I've written on this, should be out in the American Conservative, Pat Buchanan's magazine, the first issue after the election. And it's interesting that Clausewitz, everybody now politically says, oh, well, we want to be on the offensive. Bush, over and over again, we must be on the offensive. Clausewitz says, wait a minute. Clausewitz says that the defensive is the stronger form of war. And he says that's particularly true for moral reasons. And this is something everyone understands. If you're defending yourself in a fight, you're in a lot better moral position than the guy who's doing the attacking.
So we're sort of proving Osama right, that we're this aggressor that he was accusing us of being.
Precisely. As the British ambassador to Italy recently said, getting himself in some hot water in the process, George Bush is Al-Qaeda's best recruiting sergeant. I guarantee you that Al-Qaeda is desperately hoping and praying that Bush wins this election. Because as long as America is on the offensive, as long as we are pushing in to Islamic lands in every way we can, culturally, militarily, politically, this minimizes the internal disputes within Islam, which are, again, very serious, and allows them to unite, focusing on us. To the degree we stood back and said, your world is your world, we would accentuate those disputes. And by the way, whoever has the oil has to sell it. You can't drink it. You can't pour it on date palms and have them grow. You've got to sell it. And it doesn't really make a great deal of difference to us who we buy it from.
So I guess the biggest problem I have is that everybody in D.C. and New York City are so incredibly stupid that they can't understand just what you described, that intervening makes it harder. Like the young people in Iran who are more and more pressure building against the mullahs in Iran, and then we come in threatening them, and all of a sudden nationalism is on the rise, and all those young people want to fight for the mullahs.
Precisely. That's exactly what happens.
I mean, I'm just some dumb kid, and I can figure this out. I mean, what's going on here?
As I said, it isn't a matter of stupidity. Ultimately, it's a matter of corruption. And it's not simply corruption in the form of envelopes of money under the table. Very few politicians are stupid enough to do it that way anymore. It's a corruption of institutional purpose, and it includes virtually all of Washington. It includes the higher levels of our military. As I said, what really matters to all the people in those kinds of positions is not governing the country or what our strategy should be or how to fight fourth-generation war or anything that relates to the outside world. What matters to them is being successful themselves in court politics.
See, now we come back to the crisis of the legitimacy of the state.
Precisely. And that is what it's at the core of fourth-generation warfare everywhere. It's not a military phenomenon. state has forgotten the new class, to use Jevis's term. And the new class everywhere has three basic characteristics. First, it can't make things work. Look at America's public schools. Second, it uses its own position and money and power to exempt itself from the consequences of things not working. Its kids go to private school. And third, the only thing it really cares about is remaining the new class. We have a one-party state in this country at the moment. It offers you two candidates, but they both represent the same things, and regardless of which one wins, nothing changes. What remains the same is that the establishment remains in power. The new class remains the new class, and that's all it cares about. So it isn't a matter of stupidity. Many of these people are very bright. It's essentially a matter of corruption.
Well, and you've written along those lines that America itself is a prime candidate for this type of warfare to break out here because of the reasons you just said, the one-party state posing as two.
Yes, and now when you add on top of that the poisonous ideology of multiculturalism, which itself is a product of the cultural Marxists of the Frankfurt School, whose stated goal was the destruction of Western civilization, you've got an almost ideal mix for fourth-generation war. Not imported as it was on 9/11, but homegrown, as we saw with Timothy McVeigh. We are importing fourth generation warfare by the boatload with our immigration policy. But even more, when those immigrants come here, instead of being assimilated as they were a century ago, they're told, "Oh no, maintain your own culture, maintain your own identity, maintain your own language." Well, in a fourth generation world, multicultural countries break up and fight. It's laying the basis for us becoming Yugoslavia.
Well, and do you refer to any specific group of people immigrating to America?
Well, obviously the Hispanics are probably the number one element I'm talking about.
See, I'm kind of confused by that because it seems to me like the Hispanics, they are Christendom and Western civilization.
Not really.
So what's the difference?
Not really. These people, we call them Hispanics, but it's a misnomer. They're mestizo. A great deal of the actual way of life that they bring has a lot more in common with the old Indian cultures than it does with Spain. And also remember that Spain, by the time it was really forming the cultures down there, particularly by the 17th century, Spain is corrupt. In fact, if you want to really find an analogy to the situation the U.S. is in today, look at 17th century Spain. And it's really quite remarkable, the parallels. Particularly that the Spanish knew they were in decline and there were many proposals for reform, some of which probably would have worked, but none of them could cut through the interests at court in Madrid that lived off the decay, just as the interests in Washington today live off the decay.
So instead they just continued to lash out until it was their destruction.
Right, and in the Middle East is our Spanish Netherlands. We won't let it go for economic reasons, and we're just going to bleed to death there, the way Spain bled to death for 80 years in the Netherlands. But the basic problem is that these people are coming in such enormous numbers that even if our national policy was still assimilation, it would be very difficult. But now you add the multiculturalism stuff, and this isn't the fault of the immigrants. I mean, over 80% of the Hispanics want English as the official language. Hispanic parents hate things like bilingual education because it dooms their kids economically. What is pushing that is the politically correct and culturally Marxist elites in this country that see immigration as one more tool for destroying our traditional culture.
Well, that makes sense. The best way to fight it would seem to me, is by teaching the philosophy of individualism.
Well,
I mean, after all, that's why people want to come here, so they can own property and be rich, and isn't that how to get them to assimilate?
Well, no, I think there's rather more to it than that. If we look back a century ago, what we required was Americanization. What that meant in turn was, at least in the public square, in your dealings with other people outside your home and your immediate family and community, you had to adopt Anglo-Saxon values. You had to behave according to Anglo-Saxon norms, things like your word is your contract. A handshake is as good as a written contract. You do things the way they're supposed to be done, and you do them on time. You don't cheat and connive and promise people one thing and deliver them another. These Anglo-Saxon cultural rules were central to the fact that America became a place where people could make a lot of money, where people could come as immigrants and within a couple generations do very well indeed. If you want to see a brilliant example of Americanization, look at the New York City public schools a century ago. They were overwhelmed by immigrants from the shtetls of Ukraine, from Sicily, from Greece, from every places that were very tradition. But what came out of those schools were people who in the public square behaved like Anglo-Saxons. And as a result, again, within a generation or two, they were very prosperous. They were members of the middle class. Now, what happens in our schools is precisely the opposite.
And you think this is deliberately in order to weaken America?
Yes, of course. This, again, some of the research we've done at Free Congress Foundation, and we'll be putting up in the next month or so a short book on our website that will lay this all out. What we call political correctness, which is now the official or unofficial, at least, state ideology in this country, the ideology of the baby boom generation, of which I'm a part, is, in fact, Marxism translated from economic into cultural terms in an effort that goes back not to the 1960s, but to World War I, and particularly to intellectuals like Gramsci in Italy, Georg Lukács in Hungary, the Institut für Sozialforschung, the Institute for Social Research, which was established at Frankfurt University in 1923 and came to New York City in 1934. These people who created this cultural Marxism, which was intellectually very difficult because you've got to contradict Marx on a number of points. And all of the multiculturalism, the feminism, all of this stuff we're dealing with now is largely a product of this cultural Marxism. And its goal, its specific goal, is the destruction of Western civilization.
And so even though we preach American values, the values that we're preaching aren't really American ones anymore.
No, what's now being preached as American values is essentially the Frankfurt School drew not only from Marx but also from Nietzsche, and one of the things it drew from Nietzsche is his transvaluation of all values. All the old sins become virtues, and all the old virtues become sins, and that's what's now being preached as, quote, American values, unquote. If an American from the 1950s came back and saw America today, he would get back to the 50s as fast as he possibly could with this unbelievable horror story to tell. It wasn't very long ago that we were still America.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, too, why those in the Middle East would really reject our policy, not just that we're going in and killing their families with high explosives, but we're doing it all, in George Bush's words, in order to spread liberty. But the liberty we're spreading isn't individualism and capitalism as much as it's sort of a corporatist state.
What we're spreading is Brave New World. There were two alternate totalitarian futures that when I was a kid in school we all had to read, 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And with the fall of the Soviet Union, we avoided 1984, but now America itself is moving to impose Brave New World everywhere, if necessary, with military force. And the people like bin Laden are quite intelligent, quite well-educated people, and they see what we're doing for what it is. They don't want to be part of Brave New World. And on that point, I certainly am in agreement with them, not on much else.
Well, and you, in your writings, you say that nobody here in America has decided to see this battle for what it really is, that Osama bin Laden does see the kind of battle that he's fighting, but the people over on this side don't. And to me, that's, in a way, almost an encouragement. It sort of seems to indicate to me that the Wilsonian dream of a one-world state under the United Nations is absolutely impossible. It's not just a pipe dream, but it's literally insane.
From my perspective, what we have is two vast titanic forces in collision that will define the 21st century. On the one hand, you have the forces of fourth-generation warfare. Currently, they're not necessarily always led by Islam. On the other side, you have Brave New World. My problem is I represent a third party, the remnants, and it's not more than that at this point, of Christian civilization. And if anything is to survive a Christian civilization, what has to happen is both of the others have to lose.
Well, what's the best way to get them to both lose so that
no idea.
Your side can win?
I have no idea. That is in the hands of God.
Well, and it's in the hands of the American people, too, isn't it?
I wish I could say that, but at this point, the American people are no longer citizens. They're merely consumers. Their attitude toward any of this is simply, hey, the game's on. Let's turn on the tube. The American people are no longer a serious people. I hate to have to say it, but it's true.
Well, I hate to have to agree with you, but I do. Everybody, William S. Lynn is the director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation, is a former congressional aide, and is the author of a ton of books and articles on war and military strategy. You can read his syndicated column at antiwar.com or lewrockwell.com. You can look him up at the Free Congress Foundation. And, sir, is there any closing comments, anything you'd like to leave us with?
To anyone who wants to think more about this, again, Martin Van Creffel's wonderful book, The Transformation of War. It's the best book, this is all.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, sir.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. It's the Peter Principle. I'm Scott Horton filling in for Peter Shank. He will be back tomorrow. You can check out my archives at weekendinterviewshow.com. We'll be right back.